From NPR News, this is a special report on the life of Steve Jobs. I'm David Greene. Steve Jobs died Wednesday. He was 56 and was surrounded by his family. To many, Stephen Paul Jobs was an innovator, an inventor on par with the likes of Thomas Edison or Alexander Graham Bell. To consumers, Jobs was the casual CEO, casual in his blue jeans and black turtleneck, boldly introducing Apple's hot new product. To some colleagues, Jobs was a shrewd manager, sometimes a micromanager, convinced that he knew what consumers wanted even before they knew themselves. Steve Jobs was known for being intensely personal, criticized for hiding his health condition from investors and from the public, so it seems unsurprising that neither his family nor Apple released the details of his death. What we do know is Jobs fought a long battle with pancreatic cancer. It's a disease that usually kills quickly, but Jobs had a rare form of the cancer that spared him for some time. Speculation that his health was declining began to grow in August when Jobs stepped down as Apple's CEO. During this hour, we'll remember Jobs' life and his impact on society. We'll also listen back to his 2005 Stanford commencement address when he talked about a tough upbringing, being fired by Apple, and his battle with cancer. We begin with this look back at Steve Jobs' career. Here's NPR's Laura Seidel.
The iPhone, the iPod, the iMac, the iPad.
It boggles the mind to think about all the things that Steve Jobs did.
Roger McNamee worked with Jobs on several projects. He says Jobs brought us desktop publishing, computer animated movies, the first commercially successful computer.
Any one of which would have qualified him as one of the great executives in American history. The sum of which put him in a place where no one else has ever been before.
And Jobs was as much a great executive as he was an inventor.
To me, he is of his era what Thomas Edison was to the beginning of the 20th century.
Steve Jobs was just 21 when he founded Apple Computer in his garage in Los Altos, California. In 1977, when Jobs and his partner Steve Wozniak released the Apple II, most computers were big enough to fill a university basement or were do-it-yourself kits for hobbyists with soldering irons.
The Apple II was a huge hit.
Leander Caney is the author of Inside Steve Jobs' Brain.
That was really the first blockbuster PC that anyone had seen, and it made Apple the biggest computer manufacturer in the nascent computer industry.
The Apple II had sound, and it was the only computer on the market with color graphics. You could hook it up to your TV set and play games on it. It also had a spreadsheet program that made it popular with small businesses. But in 1981, Apple got some serious competition when IBM released its first personal computer. IBM had the advantage of its well-known trusted name. Apple countered with the Macintosh. The Mac's signature was that it was easy to use. The Mac was an example of the kind of product that would define Steve Jobs' entire career. Author Caney.
Jobs' idea was that we'll make it easy enough that anybody can do it. A grandmother, a kid, you know, people who don't have any experience.
With the Mac, Steve Jobs introduced the first computer to the public that had a mouse, graphical user interface, pull-down menus, and icons. Jobs, a California boy, loathed the kind of conformist East Coast culture represented by IBM. In 1984, when he released the Mac, Jobs sent that message to millions with one of the most famous television commercials of all time. The ad aired once during the Super Bowl. The minute-long commercial referenced George Orwell's 1984. A woman dressed in bright-colored shorts runs into a room of gray-looking people and throws a sledgehammer at a screen where Big Brother, read IBM, is talking.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Jobs said computers were tools to unleash human creativity.
Part of what made the Macintosh great was that the people working on it were musicians and poets and artists and zoologists and historians who also happened to be the best computer scientists in the world.
That's Jobs in the 1996 PBS documentary Triumph of the Nerds. In many ways, Steve Jobs was the poet of the computer world. He'd gone to India and become a Buddhist. He took LSD and believed it had opened his mind to new ways of thinking. But Jobs' iconoclastic ideals did not always make him easy to work with. Trip Hawkins was the marketing director of Apple until 1982.
He was just a terrible manager and a terrible executive. And at that point in time, I really never thought that he could be a CEO.
In fact, in a boardroom coup, the man that Jobs hired to be CEO of his company, John Sculley, got him fired in 1985. But Jobs was still driven to make computers vehicles for creativity. After he left Apple, Jobs purchased a little-known division of Lucasfilm and renamed it Pixar. In 1995, Pixar released the first animated feature to be done entirely on computers, Toy Story. It's about the secret life of toys, like Slinkies and a talking cowboy doll.
Slink.
Oh, well, all right. You can be right if you want.
Not now, Slink. I got some bad news.
Bad news?
Toy Story was a major hit, and Pixar followed it with other big hits, Bug's Life, The Incredibles, Cars. But in the years since Jobs had left Apple, the company had gotten into trouble. It had less than 5% of the computer market, and most analysts predicted its demise. The board invited Jobs to come back and run his old company. In 1998, Jobs introduced the iMac. Venture capitalist Roger McNamee says once again Jobs helped remake the computer industry. The iMac was the first computer made to harness the creative potential of the internet.
The transition of consumers from passive consumption of content to active creation of entertainment, so that people write their own blogs, they make their own digital photographs, they make their own movies. And Apple made all the tools to make that easy, and they did it at a time when Microsoft just wasn't paying attention.
Jobs next set his sights on the music industry.
This is not a speculative market. And because it's a part of everyone's life, it's a very large target market all around the world.
There were MP3 players on the market, but none of them were easy to use. Jobs helped engineer the iPod, which he introduced at a trade show in San Francisco in 2001.
This amazing little device holds 1,000 songs, and it goes right in my pocket.
The iPod was a classic Jobs product, easy to use and nice to look at. Apple sold tens of millions of iPods. The iTunes store became the number one retailer. 6 years later, Apple released the iPhone. Again, there had been other devices that put a phone and a music player together, but none of them were as elegant and easy to use. Susan Rockrise, a creative director who worked with Jobs in the late 1980s and early 1990s, says that was Jobs' signature.
Simplifying complexity is not simple. It is the greatest, greatest gift to have someone who has Steve's capabilities as an editor and a product designer edit the crap away so that you can focus on what you want to do.
Jobs' last game changer was the iPad. For years, the computer industry had tried but failed to find a formula for sleek computers. And for years, people had been talking about ebooks. But it wasn't until Apple entered the market with the iPad that the promise of sleek computers and ebooks came together. Rockrise believes Steve Jobs has touched every person who clicks a mouse, sends a photo from their desktop to the internet, publishes a book at home on their computer, enjoys portable music, or a computer animated movie. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
As Laura just said, Steve Jobs' innovations seem to touch people everywhere. And that includes places as far-flung as this Apple store in China. And NPR's Frank Langfitt is in Shanghai, and he dropped by that Apple store after news broke of Jobs' death. And Frank, paint us a picture, if you can, of the store and the scene there.
Yeah, sure, David. It was very interesting. It's the National Day holidays here in China, so there are tons of people on the streets, and I was on Nanjing Road, which is Shanghai's most famous shopping street, and they've just opened a new Apple store there. So there were tons of people pouring by and lots of people taking photographs. Now, in a sense, this isn't all that unusual because Apple stores, particularly this new one, has become a bit of a landmark. So, for instance, I was there actually interviewing people, and one guy, a local guy from the provinces, asked to have his picture taken with me in front of the Apple store. And what was really interesting is here's a guy who was wearing a very poor kind of threadbare suit, and I knew very well he couldn't possibly afford anything in there. But he saw Apple, he saw a foreign guy from the United States, and he wanted a picture of it to take it back home to the provinces.
He wanted a picture with you because you were an American.
Was an American, he was in front of the Apple store. It's sort of a, you know, it's a global brand. It's also an extremely admired brand here. In some other stores, for instance, there was a store up in Beijing where there were actually a number of bouquets people put out there. Some people were going to the stores to express their condolences. And of course, the store is actually jammed, as it almost always is, because the products are so popular here.
So Frank, did you get the sense that people knew who Steve Jobs was? I mean, were they expressing personal thoughts and feelings about him?
Yeah, there were some people. There was a guy I met actually out front of the store today. His name is Chen Long. He's 23 years old. He had a mohawk and a Linkin Park sweatshirt. He's a photographer. And he actually said he came down to document the day because he thought it was important. And we can hear a little bit of what he had to say.
刚准备是上班完了不上班了，我想去做自己喜欢做的事吧。所以他对我怎么说呢？我。Now,
what he's saying here is actually Steve Jobs was kind of an inspirational figure for him. He talked about listening to a speech that Jobs gave at Stanford, talking about death and making something out of your life. And this guy, Chen Long, said after he listened to it, he quit his sales job and followed his dreams of to be a photographer. What was really funny is this guy, he actually didn't own any Apple products, but just listening to Jobs had kind of had an influence on his life.
And Frank, was everyone at the store as sentimental as the gentleman we just heard?
No. I went up to a lot of tables, and they were crammed with people looking at products. And some people said, yes, you know, I'm sorry to hear that Jobs has died, and they really like the products. But, you know, at the same time, they were very busy looking at the newest apps that they could get on their iPad, and they were sort of classic pragmatic Chinese consumers.
All right, that's NPR's Frank Langfitt in Shanghai. Frank, thanks for talking to us.
You're very welcome, David.
Just heard how that 23-year-old Chinese photographer was inspired by Steve Jobs' speech at Stanford University. Following this break, we will take you back to that commencement address. And you're listening to a special report on the life of Steve Jobs from NPR News. From NPR News, this is a special report on the life of Steve Jobs. I'm David Green. Steve Jobs was not one to talk about himself or his personal experiences. One rare case was when he took the stage at Stanford University to give the commencement address in 2005.
I never graduated from college, and this is the closest I've ever gotten to a college graduation.
Jobs told the students gathered in front of him that he had three stories he wanted to tell them.
The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out?
Dropping out was a hard decision, Jobs explained. He was adopted, and his adoptive parents made a very important promise to his biological mother. They promised they would send this kid to college one day. And at age 17, Jobs enrolled at Reed.
But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working-class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life, and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was, spending all the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans-serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on that calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college, but it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path. And that will make all the difference.
Now, the second story Jobs passed on to the Stanford students was about Apple. He spoke about starting the company out of his parents' garage with his friend Steve Wozniak. Before Jobs turned 30 years old, Apple released what he said was its finest creation, the Macintosh. Just a year later, Apple's board of directors forced him out.
How can you get fired from a company you started?
It was a time of confusion and reflection. Jobs said he feared he had let down a previous generation of entrepreneurs.
I was a very public failure, and I even thought about running away from the valley. But something slowly began to dawn on me. I still loved what I did. The turn of events at Apple had not changed that one bit. I'd been rejected, but I was still in love. And so I decided to start over. I didn't see it then, but it turned out that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. The heaviness of being successful was replaced by the lightness of being a beginner again, less sure about everything. It freed me to enter one of the most creative periods of my life. During the next 5 years, I started a company named Next, another company named Pixar, and fell in love with an amazing woman who would become my wife. Pixar went on to create the world's first computer animated feature film, Toy Story, and is now the most successful animation studio in the world. In a remarkable turn of events, Apple bought Next, and I returned to Apple. And the technology we developed at Next is at the heart of Apple's current renaissance. And Laureen and I have a wonderful family together. I'm pretty sure none of this would have happened if I hadn't been fired from Apple. It was awful tasting medicine, but I guess the patient needed it. Sometimes life's going to hit you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did. You've got to find what you love. And that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking, and don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking. Don't settle.
Steve Jobs' third and final story was about death.
About a year ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had a scan at 7:30 in the morning, and it clearly showed a tumor on my pancreas. I didn't even know what a pancreas was. The doctors told me this was almost certainly a type of cancer that is incurable and that I should expect to live no longer than 3 to 6 months. My doctor advised me to go home and get my affairs in order, which is doctor's code for prepare to die. It means to try and tell your kids everything. You thought you'd have the next 10 years to tell them in just a few months. It means to make sure everything is buttoned up so that it will be as easy as possible for your family. It means to say your goodbyes. I live with that diagnosis all day. Later that evening, I had a biopsy where they stuck an endoscope down my throat, through my stomach and into my intestines, put a needle into my pancreas and got a few cells from the tumor. I was sedated, but my wife, who was there, told me that when they viewed the cells under a microscope, the doctors started crying because it turned out to be a very rare form of pancreatic cancer that is curable with surgery. I had the surgery, and thankfully, I'm fine now. This was the closest I've been to facing death, and I hope it's the closest I get for a few more decades. Having lived through it, I can now say this to you with a bit more certainty than when death was a useful but purely intellectual concept. No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet, death is the destination we all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be, because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Right now, the new is you. But someday, not too long from now, you will gradually become the old and be cleared away. Sorry to be so dramatic, but it's quite true. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary.
Steve Jobs wrapped up his commencement address by remembering a favorite publication called the Whole Earth Catalog.
It was the mid-1970s, and I was your age. On the back cover of their final issue was a photograph of an early morning country road, the kind you might find yourself hitchhiking on if you were so adventurous. Beneath it were the words, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." It was their farewell message as they signed off, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." And I have always wished that for myself. And now, as you graduate to begin anew, I wish that for you. Stay hungry, stay foolish. Thank you all very much.
So that was Steve Jobs giving a memorable commencement address at Stanford University back in 2005. And whether it was his hunger or foolishness or some combination of the two, Jobs had this ability to create new gadgets, new technology that were user-friendly and would just become addictive. Exhibit A, the iPod. Now, there was a digital world of movies, TV, books, and music before Apple got involved, but the iPod and iTunes have revolutionized the music industry. And to talk about that, we're joined by record producer Phil Ramone. He's been producing albums for decades. There's so many household names on his resume. Bob Dylan, Barbara Streisand, Frank Sinatra, Ray Charles, Tony Bennett, Elton John, the list goes on. He's currently working on George Michael's next album. And Phil Ramone, thank you so much for being here.
Awesome. Thank you. Sad day, but very, very interested in how the world really has looked. I've never seen this much news or heard. And people in the studio where I'm working, it was like young people walking in and saying, man, have you heard the terrible news? And it was more shocking in that sense to see how much young people were affected by this. This was in the amazing level of understanding. Because Steve Jobs affects all of our lives.
You know, I'm really struck by you saying that people were walking around a studio sort of really in mourning about Steve Jobs, because while you know, obviously the news of someone's death is very hard to take no matter what, but his legacy, I mean, he has been criticized for sort of changing the music industry in ways that people in the industry might not like.
Well, that's the minute he came in. I mean, there were two things they were critical of. One is that the pirating and other elements of the early days of what was happening in the business. And then the other part was, here he was coming with a device that was putting out MP3s. And, you know, everything starts at some point. I mean, I saw it in my youth where, you know, cassettes, we went from LPs to cassettes, then we finally got to CDs. I think Steve knew, and I think he revolutionized it for the positive side. And you need a Steve Jobs, who was brilliant at not only discussing what was coming, but he was a music lover. And I know for a fact that there'll be new changes. The stuff that he has left as a legacy will not be stopped.
You think that this move toward digital listening, digital purchasing was inevitable, and Steve Jobs just you know was a part of it, didn't cause it himself?
No, he certainly didn't. I think as the high speed and the ability to put music in the pipeline, if any credit is given to Steve Jobs, it's about he's allowed young people at every age. I mean, I have a grandchild who's 5, and, you know, he thinks it's normal to just be able to pick up the iPod and listen to hundreds of songs. And as you start to teach kids, the iTunes world is where they are landing. You couldn't learn that in 10 years, what's going on.
Well, Phil Ramone, that was one question I had for you. Say that the iTunes world is where people are landing, and I guess I wondered, can everyone land there? I mean, if you don't have the money for, you know, a computer to be able to get iTunes, if you can't afford to have an iPod, you know, does it lock out some people from, you know, enjoying music these days?
No more than original. You know, when we were kids, radio was the informant. You know, and you saved up if you could buy a 45, the 99 cents, and here we are, you know, many, many years later. And, you know, digital radio or terrestrial radio has to find a way to get to young people, because they don't have any real association with it. And I think that your friends having an iTunes account or even thinking of it, we have to use that in the classroom. I feel that, you know, music education is all part of listening, being able to appreciate. Maybe you're not the best athlete in the world, and you get all of this other kind of education, because once you can touch the buttons, you can go to the different categories. I think at some point the buying of a device will lower. I'm sure that the big plan here is to get more sold and bring an audience back to us. I think you can build up an audience off of iTunes. I don't think it's age conscious. You know, I see wonderful young artists who are 11 to 17 or 18. And then the veteran artists, you know, they really have an audience for a long time. And, you know, you see it at their concerts. But what are they going to do, sell a CD at the concert all the time? I think not.
Before I let you go, do you still play LPs and CDs, or have you gone totally digital?
No, I'm pretty much totally digital. I'm looking for how we can share better quality, and in the car, I definitely play CDs. But I also have my iPod plugged in. For my work, leaving the studio is constantly in a digital format.
We've been speaking to record producer Phil Ramone. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, David.
One musician who knows what it's like to get caught up in the iPod world is Leslie Feist, or just Feist as she's known on stage. She grew up as a teenage punk rocker, but 4 years ago, her song 1234, which you're listening to, was used in a television commercial for the iPod Nano. That helped turn her into a star. I spoke to Feist about her 2007 song recently on Morning Edition.
When I first played 1234, it was on stage in San Francisco at some kind of like sticky floored club. And it felt like a punk song. I mean, it's ridiculous to say that now, but it had that kind of like piercing straight melody and then this fist pumping ending. You know, that ba-da, ba-da. It just felt so simple in an absolutely non-patronizing way. And so it's so funny that the song that I approached with that sensibility became what it did and turned everything on its head.
Was there... The iPod commercial catapulted her onto the commercial main stage in a way she never planned. The whole experience led her to take a few years off to rediscover herself and her music. Now, in 1994, the Apple brand had become pervasive. You remember the scene from the 94 film Forrest Gump? Tom Hanks' character goes to the mailbox and opens up a letter with the Apple insignia.
So, I never went back to work for Lieutenant Dan. Though he did take care of my Bubba Gump money, he got me invested in some kind of fruit company. And so then I got a call from him saying, we don't have to worry about money no more. And I said, that's good. One less thing.
If we thought the Apple brand was making its mark on our culture then, turns out that was just the beginning. Coming up, a conversation with two former Apple directors. One worked with Steve Jobs. The other worked at Apple during the period when Steve Jobs was gone. And you're listening to a special report on the life of Steve Jobs from NPR News. From NPR News, this is a special report on the life of Steve Jobs. I'm David Greene. One testament to Steve Jobs' legacy was the reaction to his death around the world. In New York City, there were candles and flowers outside the Apple store. In Hong Kong, rest in peace and we miss Steve were the notes posted outside the Apple store there. And in techno-savvy Tokyo, customers held up flickering candles, well, digital ones, on their iPhones and iPads. President Obama released a statement saying Steve Jobs was among the greatest of American innovators. The president went on, "The world has lost a visionary, and there may be no greater tribute to Steve's success than the fact that much of the world learned of his passing on a device he invented." Microsoft's founder Bill Gates said he and Jobs were colleagues, competitors, and friends over the course of more than half their lives. Gates said it was an insanely great honor to have worked with Jobs. He added, "I will miss Steve immensely." Facebook CEO and founder Mark Zuckerberg thanked Jobs for being a mentor and friend. Zuckerberg said Jobs showed that what you build can change the world. Over the years that Steve Jobs built Apple, he was known for having a unique business sense, this ability to trust his intuition and convince smart people to work in the service of his vision. Jobs spoke in that Stanford commencement speech that we heard about the time he spent away from Apple. In 1996, when he was leading the successful film studio Pixar, he gave an interview about what had gone wrong at Apple. It was a moment when the company he founded out of his garage was threatened with collapse.
I mean, Apple was a company that was based on innovation. When I left Apple 10 years ago, we were 10 years ahead of anybody else. It took Microsoft 10 years to copy Windows. The problem was is that Apple stood still. Even though it invested cumulatively billions in R&D, the output has not been there, and people have caught up with it, and its differentiation has eroded, in particular with respect to Microsoft. And so the way out for Apple, and I still think Apple has a future, there's some awfully good people there, and there's a tremendous brand loyalty to that company. I think the way out is not to slash and burn, it's to innovate. That's how Apple got to its glory, and I think that's how Apple could return to it.
So that's Steve Jobs back in 1996, appearing on the television program Wall Street Week, just a few months before he returned to lead Apple to unprecedented successes financially and also as a brand. Now, as we consider Steve Jobs' legacy and what it may mean for Apple, we wonder if his personality and his leadership style can or even should be replicated. And more importantly, how did he pull it all off in the first place? We're joined now by two former Apple directors and also a business historian. Nancy Kane teaches entrepreneurial leadership at the Harvard Business School. She's the author of The Story of American Business from the Pages of the New York Times. And Nancy Kane joins us from member station WGBH in Boston. Nancy Kane, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We also have with us Robert Bruner. He was director of industrial design at Apple for 7 years, and today he's the CEO of the industrial design firm Ammunition, where he's focused on melding product design, brand, and experience. He's the author of Do You Matter? How Great Design Will Make People Love Your Company. Robert Bruner joins us from the studios of member station KQED out in San Francisco. Robert Bruner, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
And finally, we have Trip Hawkins, who was director of strategy and marketing at Apple Computer in the early 1980s. He left Apple and founded the video game publisher Electronic Arts, a company that was responsible for, among other things, John Madden football video games. Think EA Sports. He's now the CEO at Digital Chocolate, a gaming developer for social media websites and mobile devices, and he joins us from his office in San Mateo, California. Trip Hawkins, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Trip Hawkins, let me start with you. You were in charge of strategy and marketing for Apple Computer. What was your job? What were your priorities? And I guess I'm wondering if you set your own agenda or if you often found yourself yielding to Steve Jobs and his ideas.
I worked very closely with Steve, and there were times when he had brilliant ideas and there were times when he had stupid ideas, and sometimes he didn't know the difference. But you know, he's a very, very smart guy, very passionate, and very good at making arguments in support of what he believes in doing. And, you know, when he had a good idea, it was obviously a lot easier to galvanize other people around it.
You said an interesting thing that our listeners heard from you earlier in this program, and that was that you did not see Steve Jobs as CEO material. Why is that?
In the very beginning, he was, I think he was called vice president of product development in those days. And there was really a troika running the company. Mike Markla, who was really the adult supervision, and his title was chairman of the board and vice president of marketing. And then he had brought in one of his former Intel colleagues, Mike Scott, also known as Scotty, to be the president. And then Steve was kind of the product guy. And he was a very uncivilized human being back in those days. And I remember at the end of my first week working there, I was chatting with Mike Markla in a hallway, and Steve darted past a corridor, probably 30 feet away from us. And I just looked at Mike and I pointed at Steve and I said, "We have to do something about that." And I pointed at him.
Wow.
And he pulled me into his office and started explaining to me that I should have seen him a year ago and how much worse he was and how much more civilized he was now that he'd taught him basic things like where you put the fork and the spoon when you do a place setting and you know where to put your napkin. And he was really almost describing him like he had been a wild man from Borneo that he was gradually acculturating into human civilization. And there were plenty of things about just normal human events and human interactions that didn't seem to come very naturally to Steve. You know, he had kind of unusual ideas about things, but you know, again, he was really driven around, you know, his vision, his mission, you know, his passion. And, you know, he was, you know, again, very good at getting other people caught up in it.
So let me turn to you, Robert Bruner. As we said in the introduction, you were director of industrial design at Apple for 7 years. You now run your own design studio, Ammunition, in San Francisco. But Robert Bruner, you've often joked that you were at Apple between jobs because you were there before Steve Jobs had returned to the company. Tell us about the way that the company operated without Steve Jobs.
Yeah, that's my running joke between jobs. I joined in 1989, and largely at that time, the purpose of my hiring was to work with Jean-Louis Gasset, who had sort of assumed Steve's role in the company of driving product development. And Jean-Louis was equally passionate and enigmatic and driven about making great things. So, I went through this interesting transition where, you know, sort of post-Jobs, there was very much that sort of autocratic approach to product development. Then moving to Scully, who was more consensus-oriented, and then to Spindler, who was less interested in design and development, more in the operational side of the business. So I saw a very slow but obvious culture shift, you know, towards a different mode. And it really placed a lot of challenges on design. Ultimately, one of the reasons I ended up leaving was that it just wasn't any fun anymore.
Do you feel like if you had been there when Steve Jobs got back, that it would have suddenly been easier to be that creative individual? I mean, is from what you're hearing, do you wish you had been there when Jobs came back?
I probably would have been fired. I mean, just being part of the period before. When Steve came back, he looked and saw this underutilized, incredibly strategic, crucial resource and said, look, you know, we're going to, this is one thing that Apple does and knows better than virtually any company in the world or definitely within the technology arena. You know, I'm going to take these guys and put them in a position to be successful, and then I'm going to drive them to be successful. You know, I mean, the thing that Steve, I think, brought to Apple that was missing was, you know, I mean, in many ways, he's the chief designer or at least the chief experience officer, right? So, I mean, and having that type of leadership as a designer is a dream, right? It's you're in a situation where you can really do amazing, impactful things, and that's what most creative people want to do.
Professor Nancy Kane, you study entrepreneurial leadership. You know, we listen to people talk about Steve Jobs, you know, seeing underutilized resources when he comes back to Apple, driving people to succeed. I mean, tell us about Steve Jobs as a leader. Why was it so special?
Well, a couple of different things I think are important, David, about his journey, if you will. The first thing to remember, just if we look at the big arc, is that, you know, it's marked by some major failures. I mean, he's this wunderkind, right, that with Wozniak comes out with these incredible machines right on the cusp of what will become the information revolution. He's then ousted, right, several years later, right, before Robert joins the company. He then, you know, has his wilderness years, as he said several years ago in a commencement address at Stanford,
right,
where he learns a whole lot, right? There's Next, which actually, you know, he runs down his IPO earnings from Apple without, you know, a big payoff there. Then there's Pixar, and then he comes back, you know, in a kind of resurrection and pieces together all these different aspects along with his dogmatism, along with his, you know, kind of wild determination that I think would be very difficult to work for and around, and starts piecing together, you know, the next technology and what will become the iPod, right? And the iPod leads, right, to the iPhone. And then the iPhone, you know, marries some of those technologies in a new alliance with the iPad, and all along he's experimenting and looking around wide and thinking about the creative destruction in the music business and in the publishing business. And so he has not only this ability to learn from mistakes and then to piece things together like breadcrumbs from his past, but he also has this fabulous idea to keep an eye on the big picture, And then you marry that to a kind of relentlessness, right? Good and bad. But, you know, there's a great definition of entrepreneurship that says that entrepreneurs are individuals who pursue opportunity relentlessly without regard to current resources controlled. And Jobs is like that. I think there's a third aspect of this. He's relentlessly pursuing opportunity. He's looking at the big picture. He's seeing publishing. He's seeing what's going on in music. And he's building from technologies he already has, markets that he's built. He's then making inroads into related markets along the value chain, not so dissimilar to what John Rockefeller did in oil refining 120 years ago. And he ends up with a lot of market power and a big footprint. So I think if you put all that together, you have an entrepreneur who is, you know, not only, you know, a very creative person and not only a very determined person, but someone who's pretty good at learning from his own missteps.
And Professor Nancy Cain, what is Steve Jobs' legacy? I mean, did he set the standard for leadership in a way that his story will show up in every single business school classroom, you know, in the coming decades? Or was he doing something unorthodox that is sort of hard to teach and repeat?
I think the issue of Steve Jobs' legacy historically really depends on how much of his contribution, his sense of, you know, what the market wants, his sense of design, his understanding of experience, his relentlessness that Robert talked about as being so important in design, how many of those capabilities, those assets, have been effectively institutionalized in the culture, in the way it's organized, in the different systems that Apple has built? That's really the question. And if you look at entrepreneurs throughout history, there are many entrepreneurs who are very, very, very successful at the top of their markets during their lifetime. Whether they end up in the history books with more than a sentence or two, you know, with paragraphs and pages and a sense of legacy like comparing Jobs to Edison, really depends on whether they could, in some sense, obsolete themselves while they're alive by building the team, but as important, building the culture and the capabilities in the company to bring what they do to the table. And I don't know that Apple has done that. I don't know that Jobs has done that.
And Trip Hawkins, let me ask you that same question of legacy.
You know, during his career, we saw this enormous change in the world where we had a world that went from not using computers at a personal level to the point where every human being kind of takes it for granted that we use them every day. And I don't think there's anyone other than Steve Jobs that had a bigger impact on the fact that took place and the shape and form in which it took place from a product design perspective. Something else, though, not to be overlooked about Steve, that I really respect and appreciate as a CEO, as a fellow CEO, that he did that is just mind-boggling to me, is having the ability to pivot and repot himself and change his companies and have them radically change direction. So if you look at the success that Steve had in every place where he had success, he was always surrounded by really capable people. He was able to attract and retain capable people because he could inspire them and appeal to their ambition and their desire to really change the world. And then he was willing to listen to the ones that made sense and willing to make radical changes based on whatever the best new idea was about the direction to take the business in.
Robert Bruner, Steve Jobs' legacy.
You know, for me, you know, Steve's legacy, interestingly enough, is not about being a businessman. It's about being a craftsman and an artist, right? Mm. And what Nancy was talking about, of understanding all those pieces outside of the object itself that come together and form this experience, business, technology, design, all melding together. And, you know, what I know about Steve is you know, it was about making great things. And really driving something passionately and caring. You know, that's something I run into with executives that's a constant frustration of mine, is not caring enough about the quality, integrity, and creativity of the things that you put out in the world.
Let me ask all three of you. Robert Bruner, look into a crystal ball for me. What's next for the company?
Well, as I said earlier, I think the company's going to stay the course, you know, and there's... You know, unlike the time when I came after Steve had left, there's so much there that's in place in terms of ideology and thinking and process and commitment and great people, right? And
the machinery's so in place.
And great people doing it. And I think that you know, it's going to continue. As I said, the challenge is over what happens over time. And the period I was there, you know, as the company grew and it had a big growth spurt, you had managers coming in from Sun, from HP, from other technology companies who had a different way of looking at things and different way of developing things. So things came under attack. So it's a long-term effect. But, you know, right now, the understanding of what Apple is and its commitment to design and doing great things is there and is going to continue.
Thank you.
We'll just have to see.
Thank you, Robert Bruner. Trip Hawkins, look into the crystal ball for me.
Apple's a great company, and they're going to continue to be a major force in our culture. I just don't think it could possibly continue to be exactly the same when you subtract someone like Steve from the equation.
And Nancy Kane, what's next for Apple?
You know, Robert said the next few years are going to be, you know, the course the company's currently on, and I couldn't agree more. I'm sure Steve's fingerprints are all over what'll happen in terms of product development for at least the next 3 or 4 years. But let's remember the big picture. Android, Samsung, there are lots of competitors now nipping at Apple's heels in different ways. The tablet market is still completely owned by iPad, but Amazon's making a very, very interesting play. And lastly, no company, I don't care how good they are, I don't care how much people understand the charismatic and brilliant founder, can run very long on what would Steve do, or what would Josiah Wedgwood do, or what would John Rockefeller do. It's a recipe for managing yourself into acceptable decline. So 3 years from now, 5 years from now, that's really the $64,000 question about Steve Jobs' legacy and Apple's performance.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate you all being here. Nancy Kane is a professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Trip Hawkins, CEO of the gaming company Digital Chocolate in San Mateo, California. And Robert Bruner is CEO of the industrial design firm Ammunition in San Francisco. Thank you to all three of you.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
These may indeed be uncertain times for Apple, coming to terms with how much Steve Jobs was tied to the company's success. But this calls to mind what Jobs said himself in that commencement address we heard earlier. Death, he said, clears out the old to make way for the new, and right now, the new is you. I'm David Greene. You've been listening to a special report on the life of Steve Jobs from NPR News.